This evening's event, I'm really thrilled to be joined by Raed Jarar, Celeste Fala, Abdullah Al-Obeidi, Mary Tortajo, and Rick McDowell. The reason we're having this event tonight is the idea that the mainstream press will be covering the war largely from the viewpoint of the U.S. military and individual veterans. There will be far less coverage of Iraqi voices. This event is intended to fill that void, providing both factual information and analysis of what happened primarily from an Iraqi perspective, as well as a perspective of U.S. civil society that sought to accompany Iraqis during these wars. In my mind, the most insidious aspect of the U.S. war with Iraq is how quickly it has fallen off people's consciousness. I remember the lead up to the war in 1991. Living in Chicago, we had divisions that the anti-war movement experienced with consecutive weekend marches in Washington, D.C. I remember being at a hill station in India when Abu Jihad was assassinated in Tunis. The war would start the next day. One of the issues in India at that time was permission the Indian government had given the U.S. to refuel its airplanes going to war in Iraq. I remember then coming home to Chicago and being greeted with police reports that our office had been burglarized after a colleague gave a press conference about being part of the Human Shield experiment in Baghdad. I remember the yellow ribbons and the victory parade in Chicago, where peace activists were glared at for condemning the war and drawing attention to the loss of life. I remember being in Beirut in October of 2001, meeting with our partners, the Middle East Council of Churches, and Iraqi officials on next steps for our work in Iraq, work that aimed to draw attention to the impact of economic sanctions and advocate that they be lifted. I was in a hotel elevator when an Iraqi colleague informed me that my country had just attacked Afghanistan. And finally, I remember being in Philadelphia on a cold and rainy day in 2003 for the largest act of civil disobedience to stop business as usual at the federal building following the U.S. military attack. By that time, the international community and the peace and justice communities in the U.S. were united in extraordinary ways. Just 1 month earlier, in February, a global day of protest against an attack on Iraq brought an estimated 20 million people onto the streets around the world. It is impossible to separate the U.S. war with Iraq from the fall of the Soviet Union and the attacks of 9/11. This forum, I hope, is a beginning of some dialogue to think of what we can do next as a peace movement. All right, our first speaker is Kathy Kelly. This is recorded in Kansas City 2 weeks ago at a Windows and Mirrors exhibit about the war in Afghanistan. Kathy is currently in Kabul. She is the co-coordinator of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, an outgrowth of a campaign to end economic sanctions against Iraq. She lived in Iraq during the 2003 U.S. invasion and initial weeks of the U.S. occupation. Hear her comments recorded last week.
People in the American Friends Service Committee and throughout the peace movement in the United States have long remained committed to the idea that one of the ways to stop a next war is to continue to tell the truth about the current warfare that's going on in our world. And in many ways, the war in Iraq can't be considered to be a war that has ended. The ravages of that war will continue on for many decades to come. And I think it's helpful to go back to 1991. And in the time immediately following the ceasefire, when Iraqi generals were negotiating with the U.S. generals, the Iraqi generals asked, can we keep our attack helicopters? And the U.S. generals said yes. And very shortly after the negotiation of the ceasefire, Iraq's generals ordered those attack helicopters to lift off from Baghdad, and to travel south to cities like Amara and Basra and Kut and Nasiriyah and Najaf. And they mowed down people who believed that this was their chance to engage in an uprising. I wouldn't say that it was a nonviolent uprising at that time, but the violence and the bloodshed and the fear and the terror as people were mowed down, as they were imprisoned, as they were tortured, actually helped to place in power Saddam Hussein's regime unchallenged. And then added to that were the economic sanctions, so that the military warfare changed into an economic warfare. An economic warfare that crippled Saddam Hussein's government externally, but could be shown to have strengthened his government internally. And so the United States' responsibility for killing of civilians, for brutal and lethal punishment of civilians, was happening on multiple levels. Now, you wouldn't find in the mainstream media an explanation of what had been happening to people in Iraq who were bearing the brunt of this warfare. In fact, you could do a LexisNexis search to even try to find any evidence of Carol Bellamy's press conference in August of 1996, when after the economic sanctions had been, August of 1999, after the economic sanctions had been in place for close to a decade of time, economic sanctions that brutally and lethally punished the most vulnerable of people, you'd find maybe one half of one sentence about that press conference that Carol Bellamy called. And that was in the Wall Street Journal, I believe. The rest of the mainstream media ignored the efforts of the United Nations to try to say that the economic sanctions had directly contributed toward the deaths of hundreds and thousands of children. Civil society in the United States and in other places around the world certainly came into the effort of educating the public about what was happening in Iraq at a time that was too late, and with endeavors that were always too little. We have to acknowledge and admit that. Nevertheless, it's my belief that the numbers of people who did turn out, and who turned out worldwide in the millions to try to stop a war before it started, were people who had been educated by small groups of people. I was part of one small group, the Voices in the Wilderness campaign, that organized close to 70 delegations to go over to Iraq and open and defiant resistance against the economic sanctions and a refusal to comply. And I think that group was perhaps a little bit like a magnet. And eventually some of the stronger groups came on board, and certainly American Friends Service Committee, Pax Christi USA, Fellowship of Reconciliation. Many groups began to send through their networks a rising and a more acute awareness of the suffering that had already been caused in Iraq. It seems to me that we should try to encourage the Iraq syndrome and the Afghanistan syndrome. And by that I mean that if the Vietnam syndrome was such that the military elites were trying very hard to make sure that you would never again have widespread public revulsion against a war, we now must continue to tell the truth about what has happened in the United States' long warfare against Iraq, tell the truth as best we can of what's happening for people in Afghanistan who bear the brunt of United States war-making and NATO war-making, and really try to create within the public space and possibility for the kind of syndrome that establishes a revulsion against warfare and a desire never again to cooperate with the illegal and the immoral wars which move forward. And I think the American Friends Service Committee creation of not only the Eyes Wide Open campaign, but also the Windows and Mirrors campaign, is an opportunity to awaken the hearts and minds of many people, and then to try to ripple out as widely as we possibly can to draw more people in with inclusivity to a growing resistance against war. Thank you.
Our second speaker is joining us by phone, but from Maine. Mary Trotajou was the country representative from 2004 to 2007 with the American Friends Service Committee in Baghdad. She worked with Iraqi women in early efforts to create a new vision for their country. She later took that experience and worked in Washington with the Front Committee on National Legislation, beating her head against the wall to change U.S. foreign policy. Mary.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you to all who have joined us this evening, and thank you to Peter and AFSC for bringing us all together. In late April of 2003, Rick and I returned to Iraq. In a few short months since we had last visited in December of 2002, Iraq had gone from a country under siege to one fully engulfed by war. During the time we were in Iraq, from the spring of 2003 until our last visit in the spring of 2005, that war continued under the guise of occupation. I would like to give you some snapshots of that time. Much of what happened in those first 2 years laid the groundwork for the years that followed. In April of 2003, the country lay in ruins. The infrastructure had been decimated. As we drove from Baghdad to Mosul, we passed miles of high-tension electric wires that were lying on the ground as towers that held them were melted by Stinger missiles. Bomb craters dotted the countryside with clear evidence of the use of cluster munitions littering agricultural fields. Ministry buildings and cultural centers like the National Theater were bombed out shells. Ministries which had not been bombed were empty carcasses looted completely bare. Communication centers were rubble, leaving much of the country without phone service. The streets were full of tanks and military vehicles, but they were empty of people. Stores were closed, boarded up, burned out, or looted. Schools were bombed or looted. Hospitals were overflowing with injured, but depleted of medical supplies. Electricity was scarce or non-existent. The neighborhoods were no longer safe for women and children. With the first waves of lawlessness, the children who flew kites in our house, in front of our house, were locked away in their homes. A child in our neighborhood was kidnapped while riding his bike and held for ransom. A family around the corner was robbed at gunpoint in their home. Women stopped driving and going to the store. Barricades went up at the ends of our street to keep bandits out. The wife, children of our landlord, fled to Amman among the first wave of refugees to flee the violence. There was no law and order, as there was no government. As life became more insecure, people armed themselves and looked to groups that might protect them. Group identification by tribe, religion, or political affiliation became increasingly important as a means to security. Armed militias were formed. In our first weeks in Baghdad, friends took us to visit friends of theirs whose family compound had been bombed by the U.S. One of two houses had been destroyed, and all but one small child had been killed. The grandparents of the infant girl were now in their old age, having to raise this child and mourn the loss of their son, his wife, and another child, two daughters and a sister. They wanted to know who would compensate them for their loss. We met our elderly neighbor across the street whose husband had been killed on the day of the fall of Baghdad. As he drove to his pharmacy that day, he did not understand the directions of the U.S. military and failed to stop as they ordered. They shot him in his car as his wife sat beside him. Weekly, sometimes daily, friends would knock at our door to tell us of the shooting of a brother at a checkpoint, or the death of a friend when they drove too close to a military convoy, or an uncle swept up in a night raid. Often they did not know someone was dead or alive or in prison. We went to the hospital and saw there was no medicine. We went to the Ministry of Health and saw there was nothing. No desks, no files, no chairs, no telephones, nothing. We went to the universities and saw bombed out buildings, charred remains of books and looted libraries, and empty classrooms. All the mechanisms of daily life were destroyed or compromised. There was no government, no police, no functioning ministries. The U.S. declared the war was over and the occupation had begun. They appointed Paul Bremer, the governor of Iraq, to rule by decree. We visited the palaces which the U.S. military had taken over and the Green Zone where they established their government. We learned that the ministries, health, education, electricity, agriculture, would be administered by a shadow cabinet of U.S. and coalition partners. The order for the disbanding of the military left hundreds of thousands of men without jobs and their families without income. The debasification order put thousands of administrators, professors, and bureaucrats out of work. The spokesman for the occupation government said that this was too bad, that many would suffer, but that it was the price that needed to be paid. We heard a U.S. official state that Iraq would become a great capitalist nation, society, no matter what the cost. When Bremer appointed the first Iraqi ministers, he did it by religious sect and ethnicity. People called this the Lebanization of the government and said that the groundwork for civil war was being laid. Literally, truckloads of dollars were brought into the country and dispersed as the spoils of war, to contractors and allies. The money for hospitals, electricity, and clean water flowed into the pockets of corrupt American and Iraqi contractors. While Baghdad sweltered in the summer heat without electricity, we met by chance on a flight to Amman the Texan who was in charge of restoring the electric grid. He told us that everything was great. There was more power than there had ever been. We told him we lived in a home without a generator, and that we often went 24 hours or more without power. He avoided us on the return flight. There was another side to all this grimness. Despite the looting, our friends in Mosul told us of Muslim neighbors protecting the churches during the Easter services and Christian neighbors protecting the mosque during the Eid. Organizations started to spring up to work with the internally displaced, who were squatting in burned and bombed out buildings. Women's organizations emerged to help protect and educate women, minister to the widows and orphans, advocate for the rights of women and children. Schools reopened with families standing watch to protect the children. Doctors and teachers worked without pay. Trade unions emerged, organized, and marched in the streets for their rights. Where the government was unwilling or unable to help the people helped themselves and each other. Our first Christmas in Baghdad was spent at a home for disabled women run by a group of young people. As darkness fell on Christmas Eve, we heard and felt the U.S. bombs falling on the nearby neighborhood of Dora. Our young Iraqi hosts continued their annual preparation of food for over 154 families, shared presents with the women they cared for, and prayed for peace in their country. It is the most memorable Christmas I have ever spent. The seeds of Iraq's future were planted in those first 2 years. Division, revenge, corruption, cronyism, sectarianism, greed, violence. But what also emerged was the strength and courage of the Iraqi people in the face of such suffering. As Iraqis used to tell us during the years of sanctions, Iraqis know the difference between the people of a country and the policies and governments of the country, including their own. So also do we. I would close with what I see as one of our challenges for the future. An Iraqi friend recently told us a story. When Rick and I, as AFC representatives, went to visit the women's organization that she directs, it was the first time that she and most of the women had met Americans that were not in the invading military. They had come to believe that all Americans were there to harm them and take away their country. Meeting us and working with AFSB changed that. I think our challenge is to try to find a way to connect as people of peace with those who have suffered so greatly from our nation's war. This will be our path to reconciliation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. And if you can't hear, there was applause here. I should probably tell you, the speakers, there are people in the room here, so you have a captive audience, and people have braved a blustery winter evening here in Philadelphia. Our next speaker is Rick McDowell, who, among other things, is married to Mary Cotejo, who just presented. Rick has led 15 delegations to Iraq between 1996 and 2000. and 3 to witness the impact of comprehensive economic sanctions. In 2002, he led a group of Nobel laureates, and with his wife Mary was the AFSC country, Iraq country representative from 2003 to 7, also working in Washington, D.C. Welcome, Rick.
Well, thank you, Peter, and thank you for including us in this important discussion this evening. It's really great to be back amongst the AFSC community. Tonight, we took a look back as we move forward. For Mary and I, our Iraq experience is a living experience, but we maintain contact with so many Iraqi friends, both in the diaspora and in Iraq as well. We also maintain contact with many of our Iraqi partners who we worked with when we were with AFSC. Mary and I spent the first night of the war in the AFSC apartment in Amman, Jordan, with Haider and her son Mustafa, watching shock and awe unfold on the TV screen amidst the cries and tears of Haider as she watched the destruction of her beloved Baghdad. Mustafa, Haider's son, was seriously injured in 1991 in a U.S. airstrike which killed his brother. I'll repeat that. Mustafa, Haider's son, was seriously injured in 1991 by a U.S. airstrike which killed his brother. This decades-long war in Iraq began in August 1990 with the introduction of the United Nations sanctions, the most comprehensive in modern history, which led to the near destruction of Iraq and our people. 5 years into sanctions, then Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, in a 1995 60 Minutes interview, was asked to defend the reported deaths of 500,000 Iraqi children. Ms. Albright responded, "I think this is a very hard choice, but the price, we think the price is worth it." My first journey into Iraq was in August 1996, prior to the introduction of the United Nations Oil for Food Program. I witnessed firsthand internationally enforced starvation and disease in the children's wards of hospitals, bereft of pharmaceuticals. I met doctors who administered not medicine, but psychology, as they prepared the emaciated and disease-ridden children for certain death, while their mother stood by helplessly. At the end of that delegation, I stated at a news conference in downtown Baghdad, quote, "Sanctions is a war of mass destruction directed against an entire population, with the greatest suffering among the poorest and weakest, children under 5, the sick, and elderly. The United States has created a zone of death and mass destruction. Let me be clear. These sanctions are not only war, it is murder, it is international terrorism." Following the fall of Baghdad, Mary and I moved to, following the fall of Iraq, Mary and I moved to Baghdad in April 2003, amidst the hopes and dreams and the pain and suffering of the Iraqi people, amidst the thousands of U.S. troops and contractors. By 2007, there were more than 162,000 U.S. troops and an estimated 180,000 contractors, all of whom were immune from prosecution. Although most contractors were not security-related, I recall while en route to Baghdad's airport, seeing an owner of Custer's Battles, a contracting firm who was responsible for guarding the airport in Baghdad, welcome the co-owner, walked the grounds of the airport carrying a sawed-off shotgun with a bandolier of shells strapped to his back. Another contractor near our neighborhood walked the neighboring streets of Baghdad with 6 guns strapped to his hip under the shelter of a cowboy hat, obviously unaware that he walked the streets of central and not western Iraq. Invaders and their proxy armies seldom comprehend the occupied people, their culture, nor the realities on the ground. In 2004, following the hanging of 4 Blackwater contractors in the Sunni stronghold of Fallujah, the U.S. commanding officer who would lead the siege on Fallujah later that year stated, "The enemy has got a name. He's called Satan. He's in Fallujah and we're going to destroy him. The lieutenant colonel was good to his word. All males between the ages of 15 and 45 were denied safe passage, while a quarter of a million people became refugees. Of the 50,000 who stayed behind, 6,000 died, including those whose skin was melted from their bodies from the illegal use of phosphorus bombs. Three of the city's water plants were destroyed, the fourth crippled. 70% of buildings were damaged or destroyed. Studies have traced the use of enriched uranium in U.S. weapon systems. U.S. forces believe they have to destroy Fallujah and her people in order to save it. While the international community in Iraq try to figure out how to get emergency medical supplies, food, and water to these beleaguered and besieged people. The British Cancer and Birth Defects Foundation, in a report released earlier this year, indicates that the defects in newborns in Fallujah are 11 times higher than a normal average and rose to an unprecedented level in 2010. The high prevalence of birth defects in Fallujah is impairing the population's health and its capacity to care for the surviving children, the researcher said. When the first act of the occupation was to dissolve Iraq's army and security forces while codifying the de-bathification of civil society, including schools, hospitals, police, and fire, an act of collective punishment illegal under international law, and a major contributor to the catastrophic chaos and dysfunction that remains today. The Ba'ath Party, which controlled the majority of the jobs in the economy, required party membership of its employees. Today's Maliki government parcels out government ministries to political parties who require party membership for its patronage jobs. The regime, which is under siege, continues to deny jobs and imprisons its citizens under de-bathification policies. Violence was exploding around us during the summer of 2005. Electricity and portable water had not been restored to pre-invasion levels. Construction outside the green zone was minimal. Targeted kidnapping, assassination, suicide, and car bombs challenged the newfound hope and dreams the Iraqi families held to. At this time, numerous Iraqi friends, Sunni, Christian, and Shia, assured Mary and I of shelter as security conditions suddenly worsened. All but one of these friends are now refugees, internally displaced or dead, including our dear colleague and friend, Margaret Hobson, who was kidnapped and executed in the fall of 05. Recent calls to friends in Iraq tell us that after years of sanctions, occupation, and war, hope itself is increasingly becoming a casualty. Iraq, left with little infrastructure and public services, debilitated health and educational sectors, sectarian violence and power plays, is amongst the world's most corrupt countries. Within this chaos and uncertainty has risen the world's largest embassy. The U.S. Embassy in Baghdad employs over 1,000 State Department personnel, a Marine contingent, and 16,000 contractors, 5,000 of whom carry assault weapons, ride in armored vehicles while depending on air cover. Diplomats can no longer walk the manicured lawns of the Green Zone without armed protection. This ongoing war has defined a generation and will be felt by generations to come. We are challenged by necessity to continue our engagement in this costliest and longest war, this war of choice. For our children's children will pay the estimated $3 trillion and will forever feel the pain of U.S. servicemen and women who suffer post-traumatic stress. We'll struggle with the scourge of Islamophobia, the contagion of a targeted assassination, torture, and special rendition, Guantanamo, and the indefinite imprisonment of suspected terrorists without charge or trial, the growing use of drones to assassinate suspected terrorists, including U.S. citizens. All men and women of goodwill will be haunted by the wanting destruction of the Iraqi nation and her people, while our State Department increasingly commands not diplomats, but armies. Truth is the first casualty of war. It is up to each of us to speak truth to power and hold those responsible for the crimes committed against the Iraqi people accountable as we find ways to support Iraq's families. Thank you.
Thank you, Rex. Okay, so again, there was applause in the room, if you couldn't hear that, and appreciation. Our final speaker on the phone is this time on the West Coast, somewhere in California. Ra'ed Jarar is an Iraq specialist, political analyst, and former AFSC consultant based in Washington, D.C. After the U.S.-led invasion in 2003, Ra'ed became the country director for Civic Worldwide and was part of the first and perhaps only door-to-door casualty survey in post-war Iraq. Welcome, Ra'ed.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter, for having me. And thank you for AFSC for organizing this call in a very timely week. I think this is a good week for us to think about and reflect about the legacies of the U.S. military intervention now that the U.S. Military occupation is ending. First, let me make an important point that from an Iraqi perspective, the U.S. military intervention started in 1991, and now it's ending. So it's a 20-year war. I think most Iraqis believe that the 1991 attacks and followed by 13 years of sanctions and bombings and followed by 8 or 9 years of occupation, these are all different phases of the same war against Iraq and Iraqis. So the last 20 years of war have destroyed the country. The cost is so hard to explain in words. In the last 8 years alone, more than 1 million Iraqis were killed, and around 5 million Iraqis were displaced. This is a country of 30 million. So it's around 10% of the U.S. population. These numbers are equivalent to a war that causes the death of 10 million civilians and the displacement of 50 million civilians in the United States in less than a decade. The effect is really hard to explain in words. I mean, just to give you an example, this is similar to the story that Rick just gave about how many of the people who he knew in Baghdad were either killed or left. I went to Baghdad a few months ago. It was my first visit to the city since I fled in 2004. And this is the city where I was born. It's the city where all of my aunts and uncles lived within a few miles from our house, all of my cousins. It's the city where I finished my undergraduate degree and my high school in, and I worked there. But now when I went to visit in September, not a single person from my relatives or co-workers or neighbors or friends or family, not a single person was there. I was a complete stranger in a city that was my hometown. And my relatives now live all the way from the west coast of Canada and the U.S. to New Zealand. They are literally all around the world. And many others who I knew were either killed or displaced internally or left the country. So the level of devastation is really hard to describe with words. When I was driving around Baghdad, I couldn't know where I was. Most of the main landmarks were destroyed, and all of the Iraqi streets are surrounded by concrete walls. So you just drive through this long tunnel of concrete walls. I couldn't tell where I was, even in my neighborhood, or the neighborhood that I went to high school at. I couldn't tell. It was very, very hard for me to see how the city has been completely destroyed. The numbers that come from the cost of war in Iraq for Iraqis are really shocking. There are millions, between 4 and 5 million orphans in Iraq. 600,000 of them are living on the streets. The level of devastation that the Iraqi society has endured, the Iraqi infrastructure that was completely destroyed. Iraq turned from the most developed country in the region to one of the least developed countries in the world. Until this day, the vast majority of Iraqis don't have full services of electricity and water and education and healthcare. And of course, the Iraqis will continue to pay the price for years or even decades to come. Let me give you one last example before I move on to my next point. And this example is regarding Iraqi families and the education of women. Iraqi women used to be among the most educated in the region. They participated in public life very, very strongly. I met an Iraqi woman who has a PhD, who traveled all through Europe and the U.S. When she was younger, and her daughter was illiterate because they feel scared to send the daughter to school because maybe she will be killed or kidnapped. And I thought that's such a scary snapshot of Iraq's future. A mother with a PhD who speaks two languages and traveled around the world, and a daughter who is illiterate, who will become, a mother herself within a decade. It's a very scary thought. What a generation of illiterate, uneducated Iraqis will become the leaders of that nation within the next few decades. All of these things are the legacies of the U.S. intervention. My second point that I wanted to touch on briefly is that although we are looking back at the legacies of the intervention, and although the U.S. military occupation is ending because of the efforts of the millions of Iraqis and Americans who opposed this illegal and immoral war and occupation, although this is happening, but the U.S. Intervention in Iraq is not really ending. Although the U.S. military occupation is ending and the war is ending, but the U.S. involvement in Iraq is not. And like Rick and Mary and others mentioned, the U.S. is planning to leave the largest diplomatic mission in the world under the State Department's leadership. 16,000 personnel will stay. Half of them, 8,000, will be armed mercenaries or, armed contractors. The other half will include general contractors who are not armed, people who cook and clean dishes, etc. and around 4,000 employees and contractors who will continue to interfere in Iraq's business. These people will be distributed and located in six different sites around the country. And these six sites include the largest embassy in human history in Baghdad, four different consulate sites around Iraq, and one, believe it or not, one military airport. This is very obviously a huge presence that is not justified. It's extremely expensive. It will continue to cost U.S. taxpayers billions of dollars a year. And more dangerously, it will continue to damage the U.S. image because Iraqis will view the U.S. as a foreign country that is interfering in their business. I think the vast majority of Iraqis would like to see a U.S. diplomatic mission equal to the size of the Iraqi diplomatic mission in Washington, D.C. So instead of having 16,000 personnel, let's think about 16. And I think this is a very important scale to think about Iraq, building future relationships between the U.S. and Iraq must happen through this scale. Must happen through building a peer-to-peer relationship that is balanced and equal. If the U.S. wants to leave, 10 soldiers in Iraq, Iraq must leave 10 soldiers in the U.S. If the U.S. does not feel comfortable to leave 10 Iraqi soldiers in D.C., then we should not leave a single soldier in Iraq. And unfortunately, the Obama administration, although he did keep his promise to withdraw the last U.S. soldier before the end of the year, he is not changing the mentality of intervention in Iraq. I think we need a change of mentality. And this change of mentality must include ending the U.S. interference in Iraq's business, and it must include fixing the damages. Because although the U.S. war is ending, the U.S. moral and legal obligations are not. And this will be my last point before I stop. Without compensating Iraqis for all the damages that happen, and without holding the U.S. officials who caused this mess and murder, without holding them accountable, I don't think we can build a healthy relationship with Iraq, and I don't think we can start a new page. These two things are extremely important for the long-term U.S.-Iraqi reconciliation. Compensating Iraq and Iraqis for the damages that happened because of mistakes and crimes, and holding the Bush administration and other administration officials accountable because of their actions that led to the death and destruction of Iraqis and their properties. There is a very good example that we can use in the compensation issue. Iraq has been paying compensation to Kuwait for the last 20 years, and that is supervised by the United Nations. There is a United Nations Compensation Commission, UNCC, that you can look up online. We can follow the same theme. I don't think Iraq needs the U.S. money to rebuild itself, because Iraq is a healthy nation. It's a very wealthy nation with so much money. But this money must go to Iraq because of our moral obligation. And the calls for this money must come from here, from within. It is something that we, as U.S. taxpayers, who paid for the war and occupation, who funded those bombs that fell on Iraq and killed Iraqis and injured them, I think it is my personal responsibility to ask for compensating Iraqis who were injured and hurt because of this war. Well, thanks again. I want to thank EFSC again, and thank you everyone in the room and on the phone call. And I will stop here.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ryan. That was wonderful. Switching now to a presentation in the room, so those of us here are going to see the whole show. I just want to mention, for those of you on the phone, we are taking your questions at questions@afsc.org. So if you have some thoughts that you want clarified, you can send in questions, and we will they will be asked when we move to question and answer. And we're aiming to have at least an hour or so for dialogue, both with folks in the room here, with people on the phone and our presenters, and also people who have called in to listen. So our next speaker is Abdullah El Obeidi, who also grew up in Baghdad, and as a refugee in Egypt, worked with other Iraqi teens. He's now studying sociology pre-med and pre-med at Rowan University in New Jersey and is active on campus and in his community with efforts to bridge the gap between Middle Eastern and U.S. cultures. I'm very excited he could join us, and it's important to hear some of the experience of the Iraqi refugee crisis. Welcome, Abdullah.
That was a little late, but whatever. Thanks for having me here. I'm very pleased to be here. How many of you guys are happy with the weather so far? Right? It's great so far, right? When we first came here, it was snowing so bad. It was very cold. We were like, after 2 weeks, we were like, it's about time for us to go back to Iraq. Yeah, we can't deal with this too much. Well, like he said, my name is Abdullah. I was born and raised in Baghdad. I lived there majority of my life. We had to move there after 2007. I received a letter, just like hundreds and thousands of Iraqis, saying if you don't move out of your house, you probably will get killed in a matter of 24 hours. So I had to move, and then I lived in different countries for a while. I lived in Egypt for about 3 years. I was able to visit other countries. I was in Libya for a while. I was in Syria and Jordan. I was able to get to know some of the other Arab Middle Eastern cultures too. And what I had in Egypt, we were there, I finished high school, I finished a little early, but then I had the opportunity to be occupied and work 5 different jobs at the same time. It was great. I was volunteering, I was very, I was learning a lot of things, which was great. And, the 5 jobs were, I was an English teacher for Iraqi refugees who wanted to get resettled somewhere in Canada or in the United States. I was also a research assistant. I was a translator for a lot of Iraqi refugees trying to get their cases to the UN. And I was also, I used to set up the cases for them and submit it to the UN with the other people. But the last thing that I did there before coming over to the States was directing the first Iraqi youth program for Iraqi refugees in Egypt, ages between 15 and 22. It was very exciting for me to start the project. I had to do an assessment before I started doing the project, and I met up with about 20 people or so. They were all refugees. They were all from Iraq. And I just wanted to get a sense of what are they doing right now, what kind of difficulties they're facing while living in Cairo, And what I found was amazing because I had the same problem. It was too much free time. That was one of the biggest concerns. Once you have too much free time and you're not occupied, because first of all, we have jobs in Egypt are very limited. Their unemployment rate is about also 10%, and so they can't really let any refugees or any foreigners to actually work and have a decent job. A lot of them, we have a lot of private schools. Public schools do not accept foreigners. They don't have any scholarships. They don't have any of that financial aid that we can get here. So that was one of the biggest things that prevented a lot of Iraqi students to actually continue their work and their studies after high school. And so a lot of them, after they were 18, they simply sat home and went online and just that's their life. They were not occupied. That's why I was very happy when I was working all the time, and my parents used to nag me all the time and be like, "Hey, stop going, you know, outside and stay late at that hookah place or whatever." But the thing is, if I had let myself just stay out there all the time, do nothing, I'd probably get involved in a lot of bad habits. And that's what ended up happening to a lot of these refugees. We have a lot of them, once they have that much free time, they start thinking about other ways to keep them occupied, mostly unhealthy ways. So once I did that assessment, I kind of got a sense of what's going on. A lot of them have that free time. Also, a lot of them have a lot of economical problems. And simply a lot of their parents don't work, limited income. And the whole house itself, the whole Iraqi house and the whole refugee house in Egypt was intense because no one was stable at all. We were unstable. If you ask any Iraqi refugee right now in Egypt, and tell them, "Do you know what you're going to do next month or what kind of money you're going to get next month?" They'll probably say, "No, we don't really. We're very unstable. We don't know where we're getting our income from, and it's day-to-day basis." And that was psychologically, that affected a lot of these kids simply because their parents are intense. Their parents are suffering during the house, so they're going to express it, probably reflect it on the children. So the whole program was trying to get them out of that zone, put them in a place, in an environment when they can actually be very active, have opportunities to learn a lot of things. So we had workshops, we had English classes, we had homework help, of course, for those who were still in school, and we had trips that, you know, we just wanted to escape from reality for a little bit, and we took trips, and they formed a soccer team after that. So it was very productive after all, and the program is still going on. One of my friends is running the program right now, and I don't want to say it's very, very successful because of what happened in Egypt in the past 6 or 5 months, but it's still going on. But after I left Egypt, we came here about a couple of years ago. It was our first time in the States. It was very interesting, because I was like the first or the only Iraqi in South Jersey. It was very, very, very interesting. The questions that I get were very, what really got me into, hey, I might want to speak a little bit to some of these people and tell them what we're all about. Because some of the questions were very interesting. Some of them were like, "Oh, you're an Arab, but you look so nice. What is that all about?" I'm like, "Well, not all Arabs are from the movie Aladdin, I promise. We have better looking people." Other questions were like, "Oh my God, you're an Arab. What a coincidence. I love Indian food." And I'm like, "Well, that makes no sense, but okay." So I had interesting questions. And that's what really got me into, hey, what about, I mean, I'm from Iraq, and I lived there, and I lived in Egypt, and I lived in all these places. What if, you know, I hold a couple of events and see if some people are will attend and want to learn about the culture? They were successful so far. I had a couple of programs. One of them was Ask an Iraqi, which is you basically just come in and just ask me whatever you want. A lot of people had so many questions. And I was more than happy to just answer these questions. I mean, well, people come in and ask questions. I feel like that's very important because once we bridge that gap, once we have that bridge between the two cultures, we're going to have such a good opportunity to communicate better and go over a lot of our issues and find certain solutions. And I found it to be successful so far. I have a lot of friends, a lot of colleagues that come up and ask me certain things about what's going on and what's the Middle Eastern perspective about what's happening in the world. And it's very interesting. A lot of them agree with the things that I want to say or that I have to say as an Iraqi. And vice versa. It's very interesting. I've been blessed to be here. I would like to thank the French community, of course, because when we first came here, we really didn't know what's happening. I mean, it's South Jersey. Come on, no one really knows what's going on. And so we went there, and then the French community in Woodstown, New Jersey, were very helpful. They helped us adjust to the culture, to the places. They were like, hey, it's going to get really cold. You better have some coats. And so I want to thank them all. And now thank you guys for the opportunity. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Abdullah. That was great. And I bet we all could hear him. And, you know, I love your Ask in Iraqi because I used to have a listserv called Ask About Iraq. So I feel affirmed that you have, yours is even better. And before introducing our last speaker, I want to take a minute to thank all of the organizations that were part of this event tonight and who will also be hosting the vigil on Friday. That'll be right down the street here. And so it includes, of course, AFSC, this American Friends Service Committee, but the Brandywine Peace Community, the Bucksmont Coalition for Peace Action, the Catholic Peace Fellowship, Chester County Peace Movement, Delaware Valley Veterans for America, First United Methodist Church of Germantown, Granny Peace Brigade of Philadelphia, Green Party of Philadelphia, House of Grace Catholic Worker, Mainline Peace Action, Military Families Speak Out, Philadelphia Catholic Worker, Philadelphia Regional Anti-War Network, and Veterans for Peace. And there's many, many more groups that are deeply concerned about what has happened with Iraq, but those are the ones involved with the evening's event. So give them a hand. Our last speaker is Celeste Zapala. She is a member of Military Families Speak Out, a Gold Star Mother for Peace. Her son, PA Guard Sergeant Sherwood R. Baker, was killed in Iraq in April 2004. His unit was in charge of guarding those looking for Iraq's non-existent weapons of mass destruction. Celeste Zapala.
I, too, am very grateful to be with you, to be with this whole community of people who protested the war before it began and who stood through all of these sad years until now we say it's officially over. I've talked to you often about my son, Sherwood Baker, who was killed in Iraq, and he was killed in an explosion. And later I learned that it was in a neighborhood near where Mary and Rick lived. And Mary heard that explosion the morning that it happened. I sometimes feel like that meant that at least someone I know was not so far away from him. But we all know that this terrible war is never over, and this hideous aftermath will echo through our lifetimes. This afternoon in Boston, some of you may know, that Carlos and Melita Arredondo, who lost their son Alex in Iraq, buried their other son Brian, who suicided last Monday. He fought his grief and rage for 7 years, and then he could fight it no more. The war has not ended. But for some, we know the war has been a great source of profit. It's estimated that the U.S. war against the people of Iraq has cost $824 billion. That's roughly $600,000 a year per soldier in country, and that does not include the salary of the soldier, which is a pittance compared to that. But it went to companies like Blackwater and Lockheed Martin and Halliburton and their stockholders and the candidates in our Senate and Congress that they support, and they've all benefited quite mightily from the war in Iraq. The burden of that near $1 trillion war has already helped to bankrupt this country, and we can anticipate in the future that the cost for caring for vets who have served will be between $600 and $1 trillion. The final bill isn't in yet. The cost of the war were done on credit, and that bitter interest is yet to be paid. Listen, a voice is heard, weeping and great mourning. Rachel is weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more. For many of us who lost a loved one in the war, the news was delivered by a grim casualty officer. Shattering and horrible. Some mothers fell to the floor. Some women ran from the room to hide beneath blankets. A grandmother had a heart attack. A father went to the Marine van and set himself on fire. In the military hospital in Landstuhl, Germany, on Mother's Day 2005, Gilda Carbonero held her dying son, Alex, in her arms as he expired from total body burns. In Massachusetts, Kevin Lucy cradled the body of his veteran son, Jeffrey, who had hung himself with a garden hose in their basement. Weeping and great mourning for all that is no more, for 4,854 American soldiers, for the 4,000 children of those dead soldiers, for 36,000 American soldiers injured, some maimed, some burned or broken in body and spirit, some who will pass their days in hospital beds without limbs, drained by catheters, haunted by demons. Mourning for the soldiers who committed suicide. Never before have suicides in the armed services surpassed battle deaths. A dreadful phenomenon that perhaps speaks to the utterly morally bankrupt war, where enemies changed faces with shadows, where any good intentions were forbidden, where by its end, no one believed we should have ever been there. Weeping and great mourning because their children were no more. I often think about the mothers in Iraq who searched morgues looking for their sons and husbands. Were some led into rooms with blood on the floor to view broken bodies on slabs to see if the one they birthed was there? Was there a father who wandered the blistered streets only to find his little sons crushed by fallen walls? Have not all of us seen villages in Iraq burying their tiny dead bodies laid into bitter ground? There can be no comfort because those loved ones are no more. I think one of the saddest and most terrible stories I've heard is of Samir of Tal Afar, who, while riding in a car with her parents and brother and sisters, was flagged down by American soldiers. When the car didn't stop, the soldiers opened fire. Her parents were killed. A memorable photo exists of this little child screaming, blood stains on her clothing, and she's standing next to an American soldier with a gun. I'm sure you've seen the picture, but do you know what's happened since then? Rakan, her brother, had been seriously wounded in the shooting and was sent to Boston for treatment after Chris Hondros' photo was published globally. 3 years after their parents were killed, Rakan died when an insurgent attack badly damaged the house where Samir now lives. It was thought that her relatives who cared for her might be considered spies, since the boy had received treatment from the Americans. An American aid worker, Marla Rosica, who helped arrange for Rakan's treatment, was herself killed by a car bomb in Baghdad. And then the photographer was killed earlier this year in the war in Libya. How many Iraqis have died? 1 million? To the great shame of our nation, we don't know the numbers of the dead of Iraq. We did not want to know who they were. As a nation, we were told not to count the dead of Iraq. The people who love them know their names and know those numbers. The UN estimates that about 16% of the population of Iraq now are refugees, and it could well be more. People living in slums without the most basic necessities, like water, used to be about 20% in 2003 at the start of this horror, and now it's about 50%. Unemployment is 50%. Inflation is 50%. There's been a mass exodus of doctors and all other professionals. The education system lies in ruins. 28% of the kids are suffering from chronic malnutrition. 35% of the children are orphans. An entire generation of people, of little people, have seen their parents and grandparents, and they're alone. The United States has walked away from this desecrated and broken nation. Now it's populated by our contractors and our enormous embassy. Our soldiers, who did what was asked of them, bring home their wounds and disillusion. And they come home to families who struggled without them and who may yet disintegrate in the future. They come home to a Congress who is examining how best to cut costs for veterans. The effects of this catastrophe of our own making will impact millions of people for years to come. And perhaps the worst legacy is how quickly it is forgotten. The war is something we don't speak of so much, even though it's gotten a lot of press in the past week. Check January. Less than 2% of us have been in any way involved in the military. Iraq is not an issue in this election. There are no war tribunals to sort out the guilt of our leaders. Only some trials for the most egregious acts of soldiers, but no justice comes to those who ordered the invasion or lied to the whole world and set a precedent that preemptive war could be blatantly promoted as policy. It is not over for all who will go on suffering. At least once every day, I think about these words from the poet Archibald MacLeish. Our deaths are not ours. They are yours. They will mean what you make them. And for all the who have died, for every child who has suffered, or is no more, what meaning shall we make for them?
Okay, thank you, Celeste. It's always moving. Okay, so we have time for some questions and discussion. We have a list of questions here. First, I'm going to just take hands in the room, and then I'll ask people who are on the phone. So first, any hands?
The question is for Abdullah. I don't know the exact demographic, but a large percentage of the population in Iraq is very young.
Correct.
Yeah, that's what I've been thinking is half of the population was under 20 at some point. I don't know what it is today, but it's a very young country in many ways. What do you think that that means for the future of Iraq rebuilds in the next 10, 20, 30 years to have such a large proportion of being so young, having, been formed at this time, but also being the next generation?
Like you said, about 50% of the population. I think it's very sad to say that about 50% of the population, and in the next 10 or 20 years, they're gonna be the leaders of our country, and they grew up in such tough circumstances. A lot of them are uneducated, which is one of the biggest problems that we're facing in Iraq currently, is a lack of education. Even if you're educated, it's not the same education we received 20 or 30 years ago, and my dad and other peers that I know can witness for that. I think since we grew up in a place of war and in a place of violence, once you have that baby growing up since 1991, since the 90s, up till now, all you can see is violence and wars. These are the images that you're going to reflect later in the future, and all you know is violence and war. And that would affect a lot of their decisions. A lot of us as young people, we're going to grow up having a lot of psychological problems, a lot of mental health issues, and the best way to look at these things is have as many educated people as possible to rescue these young people from a very mysterious future. So I just hope, I'm not very optimistic, but I just hope that it will get better.
Hey, Raya, did you want to comment on that as well?
Yeah, can you repeat the question? The voice broke off during the question.
The question in essence was the challenge that Iraq will face in that so much of the population is young and has grown up in war conditions, and what that means for the future development of the country.
Yeah, well, the immediate challenge is how to get Iraqis who are capable of running the country and rebuilding it, how to get them back to Iraq, because most of the 2.5 million refugees who left the country completely happen to be the ones who are more capable, the ones who have more or better education, and the ones who have experience in rebuilding Iraq. So that's the more immediate concern, is how to deal with the immediate reconstruction campaign and reconciliation campaign. Regarding the longer run issue, I think that ship has sailed already, and Iraq will have a problem in a few years and decades. Iraq will have a generation of Iraqis who are not as well educated as their parents, and hopefully as not well as educated as their children. So there will be this one generation, the war and occupation generation, that will grow up to be less educated and less privileged. But that doesn't mean that the country is going on the wrong path, though, because although the situation is very bad in Iraq, and although the political and economic situation is deteriorating nowadays, I think in the midterm and the long term, Iraq is heading towards a better place. So I am full of hope that within the next decade or two, that Iraqis will manage to get their act together and move in the right direction. Let me just give one historic example before I end my answer. Since Baghdad became the capital of Iraq, this happened 1,300 years ago, 1,350 years ago, Baghdad became the capital. And Iraq looked more or less the same way that it looks now demographically. In the last 1,300 years, Baghdad was either invaded or occupied or at least attacked by foreigners 20 different times. So more than twice every century. And, you know, the last invasion and occupation was the British invasion in the early 20th century. So this invasion and occupation, the U.S.-led invasion and occupation of Baghdad, will just go down its history as the 21st brutal and bloody occupation that destroyed the country and killed and injured millions of Iraqis. But Baghdad has witnessed that before. It's not the first time, and it has survived it before. I don't think this will be the occupation that will destroy the nation. I am very hopeful and confident that Iraqis will manage to fix their country after the end of this occupation the same way that they did that 20 times in the past.
All right. Thanks, Ryan. Okay, so we have a lot of questions, so we'll move as quickly as we can. Linda?
Thank you. An Iraqi woman friend here in the area, I asked her about a week ago, what do you think will happen when the U.S. troops leave? And she said, well, either we'll continue a corrupt government that doesn't give us security or electricity, in which case there will be violence because people will be angry about that, or perhaps we'll descend into civil war again. I'm curious, Raj, what kinds of future you see in the near future in terms of the political situation. Do you suspect, like my other friend, that there may be a civil war, and how do you see the current neocon campaign for a war between the U.S. and Israel and Iran? How do you see all of these political situations mixing together in the near future?
Did you get that, Rod?
Yeah, sorry, I muted. So the thing that happened 48 hours after the withdrawal of the last U.S. soldiers is that there seems to be a collapse of the political system. And this is not very surprising. I am sure that many of the people who are sitting in the room and joining us on the phone opposed this war and this occupation before it started because we did not believe that a foreign invasion could bring a functional democracy. That was the reason why people opposed the war, that a functional, happy democracy will not be brought to Iraq on the U.S. tanks. You know, that was the reason why millions of people demonstrated against the U.S. invasion. That was the reason why three-fourths of the Iraqi population opposed the U.S. occupation all along, because there is no such a thing as a functional democratic system that can be inserted by a foreign occupation. Now, unfortunately, we are living this I-told-you-so moment in Iraq. What's happening now is exactly what all of us have warned of, which is that the U.S. cannot build a functional democracy. So the system will collapse, and whether it collapsed completely or whether there were calls of early elections or a call of no confidence vote against the prime minister and the selection of another one, this corrupt system, the fourth most corrupt system in the world, according to Transparency International, this system must end, and it will be replaced by other Iraqis who can run the country. So, I mean, you know, one last point is that, you know, I think, like, one thing that I repeated over and over in the last year is that I am confident that Iraqis are capable and willing of running the country after the withdrawal of the U.S. But this might happen through the current system, or it might happen through another governing system that Iraqis choose. Now, I'm not worried of the possibilities of an Iraqi civil war or a sectarian conflict that will happen because of the U.S. withdrawal, because of two reasons. The U.S. never protected Iraqis from each other, and the U.S. was an instigator of sectarian conflict and sectarian differences. What we are seeing now is a political conflict between mostly corrupt politicians, and I'm confident it will not become a full-scale civil war. So to answer your question, the midterm, like the following weeks and months, will be hard. Iraq will continue to be a war-torn country. It will continue to be unstable. But the upcoming years and decades will be better. Iraqis will need years and decades to fix what the U.S. has done in their country.
Okay, thanks. Oh, and Rick and Mary, if you want to jump in on future questions, I'm going to finish the stack here. Richard?
Raid.
I have a more broader point, and you made a lot of observations that bounced off people without anyone seeming to notice. There's an awful lot of horrible things happening in the world, rape and pillage and all, and Americans should be taught, and we do a good job teaching each other not to show anger and hate, not to cut off the victims of victims, not if one soldier rapes an Iraqi, we're all shocked. If Americans cheer like they cheer in Libya, we're shocked at ourselves. We do a wonderful job not showing angry emotion, but it seems to have no effect on making us less violent than the people who are angry at each other. And I don't know what could be done about it, but I'd like to bounce it off you since we don't seem to want to... You seem to have a lot of good raw observations.
I think the point that you made was it was clear and it is true, you really don't know unless you live there. That's the whole thing. That's why when sometimes when I talk, people go, "Wow, you're really passionate about what you're talking about." That's simply because I lived it and I was there in the war zone. At some point, I was just a kid. I was a 12-year-old kid and 13 maybe, and we were just in the neighborhood, and all we hear is gunshots and we hear bombs and all that. And at some point, I'm a kid, yes, but my head was all messed up. I would see people getting killed in front of my house and in the house right across of my neighborhood. And I would go there and look at the guy. He's dead. He's on the floor. He's dead. And I look at him. I look at his face, and I'm like, I just hope that's not my father. I really hope that's not my dad. And I look at him. I take a good look at him. He's a stranger. I don't know him. I go walking back to my house. I go back to the same guy and just double check if that's my dad or not. Now imagine that that's a 12-year-old doing that, okay? So imagine other kids who are the same age, maybe younger, witness all these things. And there's so many stories, more catastrophic than my story. And so once you say, well, how come, you know, we're really good at hiding our anger and or hate sometimes. But in that environment, sometimes you can't. It's almost impossible for you to not reflect on what's happening in the streets every single day.
But we don't show hate, but we just managed to kill.
Well, I mean, that's I don't really have another observation about that, because that comes from here. I've been living here for a couple of years. I'm still doing some studies, but I understand where you're coming from. I can't really. I need an American to answer that. Okay. All right. Go ahead, Amy.
I've actually spoken on panels with Celeste DePaula before. I'm Philadelphia president of Iraq Veterans Against the War, and I want to answer the man's question, because I think he's a little bit like I have a different point of view. Speaking to your point where you say Americans have a good way to show, like, to hide their anger, their fear, this is very misconstrued. Celeste knows this. I have PTSD as well as several of my peers. This young man is talking about the PTSD that he has or whatever that's ingrained in him. I think that for Americans living in a war zone is completely different for Iraqis living in a war zone. We are paid mercenaries to kill young people, to kill children. I have children's blood on my hands. I have to live with this every single day for the rest of my life. There is no way I'm ever calm about that. I see my psychotherapist at least twice a week. There was a young man last week that came home off of duty, fresh from combat, and killed somebody just because he felt like it. Now, you tell me who's hiding their anger, or does the government do a damn good job of pushing this shit under the rug and hiding these people from the public eye? Because that's what happens. We get pushed under the rug. The government's trying to throw us aside. That's why suicide outranks war deaths like 3-1. Because people can't live with themselves. They come home and they cannot live with themselves. I lost my brother 3 weeks ago. He OD'd on heroin a week after we marched on the stock exchange. Right for Veterans Day, he OD'd because he couldn't take it anymore. He lost his battle with PTSD. This happens every single day. Every single day. There's not a day go by that one of my brothers is not hurting, one of my sisters is not hurting. I, in the face of homelessness in America right now, young female vets of Operation Iraqi Freedom, Operation Enduring Freedom, we're losing our kids, we're losing our jobs, we're losing our houses and our lives. We're losing our sanity, all because Dick Cheney wanted to make some money. So for me, for the war, this war is not over. We are still in Afghanistan. We're in Libya. We are in Iran with a silent war in Iran. We've been having drones over there for 2 years straight. Nobody's talking about it. Barack Obama has single-handedly started the drone empire. It's beginning stages of Bush. Barack Obama has fully fledged it. You know, he has more drone deaths during his presidency than any other president out right now. So for you to say that, I think you're very misinformed and miseducated about the subject and what's going on. I understand where you're coming from, because some people watch Fox News, and I'm not saying that you do, but some people only get bits and pieces of information and they don't see the whole story. That's all I'm saying.
Okay.
I guess I resonated most with the lady who spoke about her son who died. And I'd like to say that I think that all this has not been done by mistake or accident. I think the damage, the terrible aftermath of all of our activity in Iraq was not accidental. I would like to say that the terrible damage of this war for me is what's happened to my country. I can hardly call it my country. I mean, Bradley Manning, the truth teller, is in prison, while the person who killed maybe has a medal for all you. So this is an aftermath of the war that we're all dwelling on. And the future of Iraq, too, depends on us coming to grips with the evil that we're doing. Not ourselves, but maybe, what, 300 leaders who started this war in Iraq? You said we started this war. I think it was started by very few people. And I would love AFSC and others to start to identify who are the people that are in charge of making us an evil empire.
I guess I would just resonate with that, that one of the saddest things at my age is to realize that what I had hoped for, not only for my kids, but for this country, is gone. That we're not only, you know, a broken economy, but we, in the process, have destroyed our own educational system, and the idealism that we might once have held on to is blanketed with cynicism, and the idea that the goal of our foreign policy should be to maintain peace is a joke. And that, along with everything, is heartbreaking.
Yes.
Okay, and I have my comment, too, and I like the way you sort of tied in some of the challenges from our speakers, and I'm thinking back to Kathy Kelly's video recording where she ends with saying that we need to create an Iraq syndrome, and she mentioned an Afghanistan syndrome, and I think it's been maybe one of the biggest challenges for us as an anti-war and a peace movement is to demand the type of accountability of these elected officials or the military elite or, you know, the people making these decisions who are literally getting away with murder, and each new administration pardons them. So when Clinton came in, he said, oh, I'm not going to push the envelope on Bush. And then when Bush came in, I'm not going to push on Clinton. And then when Obama came in, he said, I won't push on Bush. And so you have now this 30-year cycle in our country of no accountability, you know, for wars of aggression. And I'm with you. I think that, you know, in addition to compensation and acknowledging the damage we've caused, the important moral element, I think there's that important maybe legal element of, you know, supporting Amnesty International in their call to have President Bush arrested when he was going to go to Canada, or to support other groups that are kind of launching these type of campaigns to really maybe raise the ante for the next elected official to think twice about another preemptive war or a secret drone war in some other country. Joan Nicholson on the phone. Your question next.
Well, thank you, though, for I agree with you. And somehow that accountability and the ignorance that people have about what has happened. If this continues, I mean, you know, the empire will continue. And I just feel that, for instance, just going back very specifically, Saddam Hussein, we got Saddam Hussein. That's supposed to be the big thing, okay? And what we need to do, I feel somehow, is to let people know that we armed Saddam Hussein. You know, I mean, it's some basic things like this in terms of recent history that we have to really try to and pass on what has been shared tonight. I mean, I've been taking notes, and I just want to, you know, try to be you know, share the especially the firsthand accounts, you know, by the Iraqis. But the ignorance. I mean, I'll just say one thing about the 2 weeks ago, students in a school, high school students in a nearby school, they sent packages to soldiers in Afghanistan. And it was support Afghanistan, support the troops, support the troops. That what is being taught in the schools is what really concerns me, too. Because there is such a propagandizing, and if in the schools the children are not learning what has really happened, and I know this then prompted me, I saw this as an opportunity to, and I've got a letter in the paper tomorrow, the Kennett paper, to try to put in a few sentences why the troops are there. And we haven't even mentioned oil, but, you know, why were we in Iraq? Oil, Afghanistan, the pipelines and the minerals and the location of Afghanistan. I mean, we've got to somehow try to, which your speakers are just, anyway, thank you very, very much. I'll just stop right here. Thank you. I'll just mention one thing about, for instance, Brent Scowcroft, though. I mean, very specifically, he was the head of Kuwait's biggest petroleum subsidiary. And the fact that Iraq is paying, has been paying this money to Kuwait, but Brent Scowcroft became Bush's senior, national security advisor. And somehow we have to just, I don't know, we just have to share this information and try to educate ourselves and others. And thank you all.
Thank you, Joan. And I feel like you've offered me kind of a softball, because I was going to tell people here, but also on the phone, that we will post a recording of this event, and we also have some handouts here that I'll post online, and as well as Kathy's YouTube presentation for anyone who's interested, and hopefully more will come of that. Okay, so Yusa.
So I was in Iraq over the summer, and just recently. I haven't been ever since I was a kid. And it's different, like, when you talk about it and when you actually go there and see things. So this question is for Mr. Raed, like, the day-to-day things with the government. And, like, my dad just came back a week ago. He's, like, right there. And we had a huge discussion about, like, just to get, like, legal paperwork, like, as far as my documents, as far as, like, my ID, like, as an Iraqi, since I left as a kid, I had to get a new ID, I had to get a new passport, and it was just such a struggle. Now, all that is happening with the help of the government, and, like, they're trying to stop fraud, yet fraud rate is so high. So there's a huge, like, irony in the situation where you're like, okay, they want to stop fraud, at the same time, it's still there. And all this happening with the help of the American government. So now everybody's been seeing the news. There's about 13 bombings like last week, and then I'm not sure exact yesterday or something, there was another bombing in the Interior Ministry in Iraq. And how is this? And the government, the American soldiers just left, and all this chaos is happening. So this is what I'm wondering: is that how does he suggest that the Iraqi government build a new government, yet it has been days since the army left, and we have this chaos again, which is going to escalate more and more. Now, since when the Americans went in, we never had a segregation between Sunnis and Shiites. I'm half-half. You know, we never had a segregation. Now there's such a huge segregation that it's affecting the government, and it's affecting the whole country, essentially, because it's in the government. So how is this going to work? As far as the government, he mentioned earlier, like, a government will develop after the withdrawal of the American troops. I don't see that happening, like, as far as now, because we need something to happen now. Like, we can't wait for another 10 years, because what's going to happen 10 years if every day there's a bombing? You know, who's going to be there still? Because people are still leaving. My cousins, I have just a couple of cousins there left, and they are dying to leave. You know, and they're educated people. a lot of them are just like, oh, you're so lucky you're in America. What are you doing here? Like, why are you back? I'm like, I want to see my country, as far as a person like me who grew up here and then wants to go back there. And then I have my grandparents there, so who refuse to leave. My grandparents have the opportunity to come, but they don't want to come. They're like, this is where we are. This is where we're going to stay. So this worries me as far as a civilian, as far as an Iraqi civilian. How is this going to continue and how is this going to get fixed, as far as when he mentioned that a government will develop with the American troops leaving? And I'm just thinking, like, how is that going to happen as far as the, you know, evidence only show, like, talk is just talk. I'm just looking at evidence.
All right, so... So Raj, you're tagged, but also I wanted there's other Iraqis here, so it'd be interesting. You know, I think if anyone wants to comment on that, because it's the big question. I don't have a crystal ball, so it's hard to really feel so secure about what the future will bring. But I think it's the right question to be asking. So let's start with Raj and Rick or Mary. If you want to jump in, and Abdullah, I'd like you to answer too.
I mean, I definitely share his frustration, and I am in very close contact with many of Iraq's politicians and political leaders who I can see that, you know, they have major problems in running the country, and all of the Iraqi political leaders are a part of this corrupt system. I think the situation in Iraq will continue to be bad, and this is what I have been saying for years, that the U.S. departure will not make Iraq a better place overnight. Iraq has been a very unstable nation for the last 8 years. Explosions has been going on in Iraq all of these years. What happened this week is not an exception. It's actually still way better than how Iraq looked like in the peak of the U.S. occupation of 2005 and 2006. What happened this week is a walk in the park compared to how Iraq looked like in those years. So Iraq will continue to be unstable, and there will be a lot of turbulence on the way. When I say Iraq will need 5 to 10 years to stabilize, of course that does not mean that Iraqis will just sit, watch TV for 10 years, and then their country will become better. It will be a very hard struggle, a daily struggle, for stability, for getting rid of corrupt politicians, for changing and improving the governing system, for ending foreign interventions in Iraq, for building a strong nationalist armed force that can protect Iraq from threats that come from domestic and foreign threats. And, of course, an inclusive political process that is not sectarian and ethnic. So the road is very long, and it's a very long path. And the U.S. departure is only the first step. So while I do share her frustration, and I live it every time I go to Iraq, I think that Iraq is going to be in a better place in a few years. And that will include a lot of movement from inside the country. That is like what's going on now, like the millions of Iraqis who have been worried about their future, who are calling for early elections, who are demonstrating in the streets now. There is a lot of political and social movement in the country. And all of these things, I think, are positive signs that we are finally moving. There is finally light at the end of the tunnel because the U.S. has left. But that doesn't mean that the situation will be better within the next few months or years.
Cool. I know we have one more comment here.
Peter, it's Rick. Can I make a comment?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, after 20 years of relationships with Iraqis, I have the greatest respect for the people. We've talked about sanctions. We've talked about occupation and war. We haven't talked about the 8 years of war with Iran back in the 80s. Iraqis are survivors. As Brad pointed out, they survived invasions and occupations over the millennium. You know, we have the good fortune of knowing Iraqis who are running non-governmental organizations. They are convinced of their own power, and they do believe that this country will eventually turn around. As Rod points out, it could be some years, but only the Iraqis can turn Iraq around. We need to find ways to support the Iraqis. What we can also do is have some say about our own government. I mean, we need to turn that government around as well.
I guess it is probably the biggest question right now is so what's next for Iraq? The U.S., they left the country, but it is still a war zone. We still have bombings every day. It's a violent place. The way I look at it, since 2003, when the U.S. Army invaded Iraq, I look at ourselves when we were living there. We were living in a cage for about 40 plus years. There was one dictator, and he was ruling everything. We had one Saddam. And that was it. We were all afraid of him. We were not, unless we want to go up there and try to work with him, then we might have a good chance. But then we got rid of him, and then what's next? We have about 200 other Saddams now in Iraq. We have so many Saddams in Iraq, and we're afraid of talking freely about any of them. So that's the biggest problem. We were in a cage for 40 years. Now you let that monkey out of the cage after 40 years. What are they going to do? They're not ready. No one is ready at all to have complete democracy. And that's the biggest problem. We need a lot of support. And once the U.S. was involved since 2003, then don't just. Well, you guys are on your own, you do you, and then we're just going to be out here. That's one of the problems. If we let Iraq handle whatever they're doing by themselves, by the government, that the existing government that we have, just an FYI, all the bombings that are happening right now, they're all political. None of them were for another reason. It's our politicians that encourage that, and that's one of the biggest problems. They have a conflict, it reflects on the people, and they have so many bombings. If they don't have any conflict, then everything is fine and everything is okay. So we need to find a government that actually represents the people themselves, and not just a made-up one that came after 2003. And most of us really don't know what these guys have been through and what did they actually live. A lot of them didn't even live in Iraq, so that was one of the major problems. So I don't think we are completely ready. We absolutely need a lot of support. One more thing I want to stress on is we need more education. That's all I have to say. Is once we have a more educated society, we're going to have better and healthy choices. Thanks.
Okay, one more comment.
My name is Hatem Mukif. I lived in the United States since year 2000. I left Iraq in 1996 due to the dictatorship regime at that time. And I was an engineer, and I, you know, was very successful at that time, but there is no safety, there is no speed, all of that. If we're going to talk about the collateral damage, maybe we're going to talk weeks and months, you know, and we can write books. what I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to talk a little bit about the political point of view, because everything behind all that war is a political issue. So we should think clearly why that happened. What is the reason? Do you think that United States is going to spend almost $3 trillion and their loved ones going to kill for nothing? It's a mistake? No. I agree with the gentleman here when he says there is some agenda. Okay, there is a plan. There is a genius people here behind the scene who planned for every step. So what I'm thinking and what I, you know, hope that to see, first of all, we have to assess all the damages, you know, that happen and what we're going to do in the future to solve that for both nations, the American and the Iraqis as well. Both of them pay the price. Of course, the price is different from here and there. That's number one. Number two, we just talk about the collateral damage. But I believe that we think about to have certain kind of, we raise our voices to impeach who made that decision. And the most important question is, what is your agenda, guys? What do you want to reach? Iraq is not only the target. Okay? Iraq was at the beginning. And as well as it, everybody knows about the, you know, mass production, I mean mass, you know, like all the weapon, mass destruction weapons and all of that. No. I was an engineer working in certain, you know, companies, and I know that there is all, everything is, was destroyed by the United Nations from 1991 up to 2003. They went into to his closet, you know, one of his boxes. So we need to ask them, what is your agenda? What do you want to reach? What's the end? I believe it's a very complicated equation. We cannot look to the Iraq as only the situation right here. It's an equation starting from Israel, ended with Iran and the whole region. I believe, from my point of view, maybe I'm mistaken, it's a different way to recontrol the region. And that's when, if we connect all these things with what's happening in the other countries. Okay, who behind that? That's the question. I will give the answer. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to mute whoever has the answer, because it's a good question. And Mimi, I know you're next, but there's a question that was handed in that fits with this line, so we'll come to you afterwards. And I'm intrigued by two things. One, some of my colleagues do a lot of work with diaspora communities, and it's always the dialogue and the connections that refugee and diaspora communities have is always so much stronger and offers so much insight and such passion that I really do appreciate that. And so I almost feel like this is an unfair question to ask, but someone did hand it in, and so I'd like Abdullah and Raed and maybe Yusuf's comment as well. Would Iraq be better off divided into three countries? All right. I don't know. Does anyone want to say more than just no? Since you can't see the room, Raed, there's a lot of rejecting that idea. But seriously, that's a question that I often get that question traveling around with pretty well-informed communities. So yes, please share just a brief thoughts on why would Iraq not be better?
Okay, back again. It's very simple. As I said, it's something planned. This is the proposal by Joe Biden.
Right. Yeah.
That's it. So that's what I say. Everything, you know, please, everything is planned. But when it's going to happen, it's steps. And it was rejected even from the American and the Congress and all of that. However, now it comes to life. He supported the chief of the Iraqi parliament when he visited the United States to have a Sunni territory. However, I just want to mention that to you that the Iraqis is very emotional people. You can see them fighting and killing each other, but next week they will work together. Now, Iraq was under, as I believe, you know, Mr. Abdullah and Raed mentioned, that Iraq was, you know, occupied maybe 20 times since 1300 years ago. So we used to get that, you know. We will be, I hope we will be Chapar for the Middle East. So it's not going to happen.
Okay, Mimi, your question.
I'm very loud. Okay. My name is Mimi Lang. I'm from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. My question is, I know the American Friends have an active lobby in D.C., and so I'm wondering if there can be some comment from friends here about this, the question of the intervention, the mentality of intervention has not changed with Obama, and our U.S. moral and legal obligation remain. And I'm wondering if there are any, is there anybody in our government who is willing and to put their legislative or Senate vote on the line as for accountability? I mean, and what, I know Friends Legal Service, whatever that's called, is probably working on that, and I would like to know more about that. First of all, my second thing is I am very apologetic to all the Iraqis here for what we've done to your country.
Thank you. We should have started that way, but it's appropriate to say over and over. As far as legislation, I don't think there's anything currently. When Obama first came into took over office, John Conyers had a bill and was pushing an idea of holding the previous administration accountable, at least as a first step, until this, you know, assuming the new administration hadn't done anything wrong yet. So now I think he'd have to expand his vision to include the previous and the current administrations. I think you're right. There's not much hope for what's happening in Washington. I think the divisions in New York at the UN are even stronger. As a result, the aftermath of the war in Libya, at the fallout, I don't think has cleared yet. We have an office that works at the UN, and they were sharing that, you know, for the first time in any recent memory, that the U.S. ambassador walked out of a Security Council meeting, which is an extraordinary step. And so everyone's polite, and even if they disagree, they don't walk out on each other at that level in the Security Council. And there's a huge difference with the way that the South, or the way that most of Africa, sees the way the UN resolution was carried out towards Libya. And whereas the Western powers, particularly the U.S. and France and Britain, feel as though they were acting within the letter of the law in being Libya's military in the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi, the U.S. and Britain and France as well neglected language in that resolution that said no arms should be sent into Libya. And they saw that as, we won't arm Muammar Gaddafi, but we'll arm the people that we are supporting. So I think even on that level, you know, there's some fight back, some pushback. And my own personal feeling is that, you know, that when we passed the 10-year mark after 9/11 this year, that it feels as though we sort of stepped over a ledge, or we stepped over a wall that had been blocking us, and that there's all sorts of opportunities now, not just the Occupy movement and the Arab Spring and all the world kind of changes, but also, I think, sort of emotionally, for people, that maybe there can be some changes, and maybe we can get back some of what we lost with the Patriot Act and all of the legislation that was passed after 9/11. And I think tied up in all that is maybe a hope down the road that there's some real legislation in Washington that holds somebody accountable. You know,
I don't really see why you have any hope. I mean, we keep saying, well, if the U.S. does this, or if you, but we're not doing any of those things. Our legislature and you know, our Senate, they're just, they're never going, they're not going in this direction. I mean, the only hope is for the empire to be completely fall apart and other empires to rise up and take over, as seems to be the solution in my mind.
Well, maybe my hope is that the empire is about to collapse.
Yeah, right.
If something else takes over, I hope it's more, a lot more nonviolent than our version of empire was. So we're almost at 8 o'clock. I do want to give anyone on the phone. Okay. David Hartso, let's hear your question.
Really sharing, I think.
Okay, no, you're just starting now, so begin again. Sorry about that.
This is David Hartso from San Francisco. I want to thank AFSC and this whole panel for this very important presentation where you've shared the tragedy and the horror of what this occupation and war has meant for the people of Iraq. And my concern is that this story is very different from what the millions of American people are getting from the mainstream media and from our government leaders. And unless we can understand the truth about what we have been doing, there's a danger that we're going to just repeat more of the same, as it seems we are in Afghanistan, and there are people there, or people in Washington seem to be threatening another war with Iran, what we've done to Iraq. So the question is, how can we get this this real story of the tragedy of this war and occupation out to the American people, and how do we help our fellow country people to learn the lessons from this war and hopefully change our government's policy for the future?
I wish that was easy. Things I think of. You know, they always say that the history of wars are written by the victors. There aren't any. We've all lost more than we can count. So we really have to keep speaking our story and correcting wherever possible and continue to be a witness. You know, I feel that that's part of what we do as human beings, is be witness to what we know the truth is and to... There's so much manipulation, and I'm not a conspiracy theory person, but God knows with the media owned by the same people who make the weaponry, you know, you got an uphill battle here. But it is incumbent upon each of us to keep speaking the truth and to be witnesses to not only what we know to be moral, but to what we know to be actual. And I think it's a very, very great struggle. But I, you know, each opportunity to speak and to say what really did happen and why it was wrong, and to not tolerate the idea that the kind of warfare that we've just lived through should be the perpetual policy of the United States.
Amongst the many haunting and poignant moments tonight, one that comes to my mind is Celeste reaching out to Mary and Rick at being there and hearing it, and I'd like to hear Mary and Rick reflect on that moment.
When Rick and I came back to the United States to do some speaking, we met Celeste in Chicago. And she was sitting next to me before each of us were going to speak, and she was telling me about her son. And when she told me about her son, I remembered that day so clearly. And I remember hearing after the explosion happened, I remember hearing on the security radio that we had that it had been a team going in looking for the fictitious weapons of mass destruction. And how much it hurt to know that young people were brought over to go on this chase that ended their life. And how touched I was at Celeste's courage to bring her son's story to people around the country.
Marlena, did you want to be on the set?
Yes.
Okay. I think in this country we tend to talk about democracy, and some of us are aware of the militarization and the money to be made by that. And someone briefly mentioned Israel, and I feel that as someone who is Jewish, that I have a responsibility to address that. And I believe that many activists, including those of us who are Jewish, refuse and deny that Israel is anything but a democracy. And the issue of militarization, whether we're seeing now that the drones are coming into this country and going to the police, because unfortunately we don't have a proper war elsewhere. So the militarization that I see both in Israel and Palestine, and our denial as activists and many Jews, yes, I will deal with any issue, but don't get into that one. I hear that from my Jewish brothers and sisters, and it's extraordinarily painful. And I know I'm sort of going all over the place, but I don't understand how I cannot be in the shoes, to some degree, of Celeste, that Celeste knows about her son, but how can I not feel for the maiming of Iraqi children and adults and Palestinian children and adults, and hold these democracies, the United States, France, Britain, and Israel, equally responsible? I'm sorry, that's not a question.
It does lead me to a call, and it's 8 o'clock. We were scheduled to end at 8, but I wanted just to make a quick round of the presenters to give them a chance to make a final comment, a final thought, reinforce a point. And before that, maybe we'll have one more question. Oh. Okay, and then a comment to Marlena.
Your point, but I want you to, we usually, when we talk about Israel, we don't talk about Jewish. There's a big separation between, the Jewish people. I mean, there's a lot of Jewish. The best, you know, people lived in Iraq, and they got the higher, like, positions in the early, 20th century were Jewish. So there is a big difference when we talk about Israel as a government, just like when we talk about the U.S. government or Britain, and we talk about Jewish people. I mean, we all brothers, so there's no separation, and we respect them as we respect Christian and Muslim and all other religions, you know. Thank you.
Okay, Rick or Mary or Raed, any final thoughts you want to leave us with?
Peter, it's Rick.
Go ahead.
I think it's fair to say that all of us on this call and in Philadelphia are really mad as hell. Yeah. And we shouldn't take it anymore. As Chris Hedges says, I think we need to be on the streets. We need to join the Occupy movement, who's saying enough is enough. We need to recognize. We need to raise our own voices, regardless of the cost to ourselves, because there's nothing left to do but that. Put ourselves on the line and move forward, and perhaps move forward with a plan.
Great. You've been affirmed in the room.
Peter, it's Mary. I just wanted to second what Rick has said. We may have removed most of our presence, if not all of our presence, from Iraq. But the Iraq war still is present in us and in our country. And it is our job and our responsibility to see that, to meet our responsibilities to Iraq and to the Iraqi people, and to make sure that this does not happen again.
Yeah, I just want to say briefly that I really appreciate the discussion today. I think it's one of these steps that we need to take. Simply because that's one of the biggest steps we need to take is we get all together and talk about what kind of problems that we have, and we have open and honest discussions about what is going on overseas and what is going on with our policies in the United States. And I mean, because yes, we ended the war in Iraq, but the victims will never be forgotten. There's a lot of American victims involved. There are a lot of Iraqi victims involved, and they will never be forgotten. And we simply do all these discussions, and we raise our voices simply because we would like to remember what they did. And a lot of them were innocent, and they had no idea what's going on. And it's not their fault. They got injured, they got killed. And having these discussions and not on, I would like to see these discussions on a very a bigger scale and in different places and different kinds of people. And I know all of you, most of you guys agree on certain policies that we have in the United States and the war in Iraq, but we would like to reach out to the people that have different opinions and have and these the ones that actually supported the war and all the things that happened overseas. We'd like to reach out to them and have a healthy discussion about what's going on and what are our conflicts, because we have inner conflicts inside the United States. It's not just the policy outside. We also have inside conflicts in here. So I appreciate having me here. I really thank you for your time, guys. I appreciate it. Thank you.
When I don't know what to think about anymore, I sometimes think about what Martin Luther King said. I'll stick with love. Hate's too great a burden to bear.
Raed, do you have a final thought?
Yeah, I would encourage everyone in the room and on the phone to contact the Obama administration, the White House, and the State Department in the upcoming days and say that we want the State Department's footprint in Iraq to be downsized. And I think this is not just something that I will be saying or you will be saying. The State Department's own Inspector General put a recommendation in 2009 demanding that the State Department downsizes its presence in Iraq. So this is a good time for us to pressure the Obama administration, the White House, and the State Department to downsize the State Department's presence to a few dozen employees. And I think it would be good to put the pressure from now so that they will hear our voices. We are happy that the war is ending, but we are not happy that the U.S. is still interfering.
Okay, great, thank you. And I want to thank Mary, Rick, Riyad, Abdullah, Celeste. Thank you all for joining us tonight. And I want to leave you with one kind of hopeful thing, because, you know, a lot of tonight felt very painful, but it was, I felt good to be in a room with people to acknowledge a little bit about what has happened around Iraq. But one of the most exciting things that's happening, and with some of my colleagues in Chicago are involved with this, is that in May, there's going to be an unusual gathering of the G8 and NATO summit in Chicago at the same time. And groups all around the country are already starting to talk about ways that they might support sort of a shadow conference or a protest or something. The G8, of course, is what so much of Occupy focused on, and this sort of ugliness of a world economic system. And NATO is going to be up to here with its next steps in Afghanistan and the U.S. role in that war. So maybe that's one of those we're stepping over another ledge. But in May, there's going to be a huge gathering. The city of Chicago, with Obama's former chief of staff, is now the mayor, for those of you who don't know that. He said that they're very concerned about safety and security, and they're thinking that they may close the loop, the entire downtown Chicago area, to host the G8, the economic barons of this world, and NATO in this war fighting in Afghanistan. So I think if we need a target, there it is. Thank you all for coming this evening.